You're listening to the Monocle Daily, first broadcast on the 18th of September 2017 on Monocle 24. The Monocle Daily, in association with UBS. Hello from Midori House in London and welcome to the Monocle Daily here on Monocle 24 with me, Matt Barbette. Coming up on the programme, they've never had their own country, so will Iraqi Kurds be allowed to vote on independence? Iraq's Prime Minister says he wants next week's referendum stopped, but there's no sign he'll be listened to. Rolling Stone is up for sale. Now almost 50 years old, the iconic American music magazine that moved into political commentary needs the cash. $80 million if you're interested. We'll hear why and what you'd get for your money. Also,
my visit to Canada today is not only about recognising our past, but also looking ahead to our bright future.
British Prime Minister Theresa May has been in Ottawa. We'll find out how likely it is she gets what she wants, a promise of a post-Brexit trade deal from Prime Minister Trudeau. Plus, we'll take a look at the Asian front pages, hear from our man in Lisbon on what's on the minds of those who bring you your newspapers and magazines, and find out why the rocking horse is rocking the design world. All that coming up here on the Monocle Daily with me, Matt Barbette. But first, a quick look at the day's other top stories. North Korea has warned that further sanctions will only make it accelerate its nuclear program. The country's foreign ministry issued a strongly worded statement saying that a new round of United Nations restrictions was, and I quote, the most vicious, unethical, and inhumane act of hostility, which is the most pot, kettle and black act of hubris. Russia's President Vladimir Putin has watched a military parachute drop as the country takes part in its biggest war game since 2013. NATO officials say they're watching the Zapad 2017 games with calm and confidence, but many are unnerved about what they see as Moscow testing its ability to wage war against the West. And thousands of airline passengers are stranded in Auckland after a burst pipeline cut jet fuel supplies to New Zealand's largest airport. The damaged pipeline is Auckland Airport's only source of jet fuel. The disruption is expected to last at least a week as work continues to repair the pipe. Welcome to the Monocle Daily. I'm Matt Barbette. It's going to be a busy autumn for Kurdish voters. They face going to the polls in a general election at the start of November. But before that, a week today, in fact, they're expecting to vote on whether the part of Kurdistan that's in Iraq should actually be an independent nation. As you'd expect, Iraq's Prime Minister Haider al-Abadi isn't happy and has demanded it be suspended. But will the Kurds listen? It's unlikely. So what will the vote and its possible outcome mean for stability in what is the most tumultuous of regions? Brendan O'Leary is Lord and Professor of Political Science at the University of Pennsylvania, and he joins me now. Good to have you, Brendan.
Good evening, Matt.
What do you think is going to happen next?
I think the referendum will go ahead, despite the pressure being placed on the Kurdistan regional government, both by the Iraqi government, regional powers, and the United States. And I think after the vote, which I expect to result in a very large majority for independence, I expect then efforts will be made to ensure successful negotiations between the Baghdad government and the Erbil government over the terms of their eventual divorce.
Because Baghdad has never wanted to see an independent Kurdistan within its existing borders.
That's true, but Baghdad made a constitution in 2005 with Kurdistan, which was described in its preface as a voluntary union. And a voluntary union can be voluntarily dissolved. It will especially be voluntarily dissolved if one party to that contract systematically breaks it. And the Baghdad government has failed utterly to implement the federal provisions of the constitution. Your listeners will know that in any federation there is always a second chamber to protect the regions and provinces. The Constitution of Iraq made allowance for such a chamber to be created. It hasn't been created. The Iraqi government refers to a Supreme Court, but it's not the Supreme Court that was envisaged in the Constitution. So Iraq doesn't have a second chamber, and it doesn't have a federal Supreme Court, so it doesn't have a federation. It has a majoritarian tyranny run by Shiite politicians, largely influenced by Iran. And the fact that the Iraqi government since 2005 has failed to respect the constitutional contract with the Kurdish people is why this referendum is taking place.
Iraq needs to get its own house in order before it starts pointing the finger at what is de facto Kurdistan, because apart from not having a currency and not having its own borders, Kurdistan is operating like an independent country already. I mean, I said at the start there, looking beyond the referendum, it's already looking at elections in November as well.
It's been, in effect, a de facto independent state since 1992. It has its own army, its own parliament, its own political parties, its own media, its own external representation. It controls its territory. It recently defeated ISIS in its territory. It has all the hallmarks of a state, except, as you say, its own currency. And the reason why the vote is taking place now is that it was initially planned to take place 2 years ago. And ISIS then invaded the Kurdistan region when the referendum was postponed. And during this time period, something crucial happened. The Baghdad government stopped paying the Iraqi Kurds their share of Iraqi oil revenues from previously exploited fields. They did this at the same time as they were paying the salaries and the wages of people in the city of Mosul who were occupied by ISIS. I can hardly think of any example elsewhere in the world of a government deliberately starving its allies of support at the moment of their most crucial crisis, while at the same time they were supplying funding to those who in effect were being taxed by the Baghdad government's nominal enemy, ISIS. This is completely unacceptable to Kurds, and it accounts for the emotion with which they will enthusiastically vote for independence.
Brendan, let's talk about those other states that have a vested interest in this. The US and the UK to begin with, because you talk about fighting ISIS via the Kurdish forces, the Peshmerga. Is it a case with the Kurds that, and their relationship with America and Britain, that they're just a case of our enemy's enemy is our friend? Once IS has been in retreat, that actually America and Britain doesn't really care so much about the Kurds?
That is, of course, a fear that the Kurds have. The position of the UK and the US is that when they removed Saddam Hussein's regime from power in Iraq, they had committed themselves to one Iraq. Subsequently, however, they too, rather like the Baghdad government, have failed to respect the constitution that Kurds actually made with Arabs in 2005. And the policy position of both Washington and London is that they would like the Kurds to stay inside Iraq to provide some pluralist balance against Shiite domination. And they still entertain the fantasy that if they do so, the Baghdad government will be independent of the Iranian government.
And Brendan, I'd just like to finish off, sorry to interrupt there, I'd just like to finish off on one more question, actually, because the sort of elephant in the corner here really is Turkey. I mean, you talk about Iranian influence via Baghdad, but Turkey and Erdogan in particular must be sitting there thinking, this is the last thing I want.
We have to be careful about that. Erdogan has had very good relationships with the Kurdistan Democratic Party, the largest party in the Kurdistan region. And so far, Turkey has been happy to export Kurdish oil. It's true they've had long-standing fears about the establishment of an independent Kurdistan, but they know that this Kurdistan has no territorial claims on Turkey. And they actually get on much better with the Kurds of Iraq than they do with the Kurds of Syria, who are organized under Marxist influence. So the Kurds of Iraq are hoping that Erdogan will come around and not persist with his negative disposition.
Okay.
And we'll see. That's going to be tested.
Professor Brendan O'Leary, many thanks indeed for joining us. You're listening to Monocle 24. This is the Monocle Daily, live from Studio One at Midori House in London. Next, the clue is probably in the lyrics of the song it's named after. If I can paraphrase the great Bob Dylan for a moment. Once upon a time, you dressed so fine, threw the bums a dime in your prime, didn't you? Now you don't seem so proud about having to be scrounging your next meal. Yes, the words to Like a Rolling Stone, and though the magazine is of the same name, maybe hasn't quite fallen on hard times, it is scrounging around because it's up for sale. So how does that feel to the man who started it, Jan Wenner, and his son, Gus, who are trying to offload the family's stake? To tell us, David Uberty is on the line from the US, media reporter for Splinter. Is this a fall from grace, David?
This is certainly the culmination of a number of events over the last few years. Rolling Stone just emerged from pretty horrendous debt load from a bad financial deal made in 2006. A few years back, it had a huge journalistic lapse with a discredited story about a rape on campus. And then finally last year, it actually sold a 49% stake of Rolling Stone. So this was certainly an inevitable development over the course of time. Rolling Stone, like many other magazines, has struggled to make the digital transition, and this is the culmination of all those factors finally coming to fruition.
Yeah, let's just chew over some of those a little bit, because people will think of Rolling Stone as being a music magazine, started in 67, started with John Lennon on the front cover, of course named not just after Like a Rolling Stone by Bob Dylan, but also a Muddy Waters track and the band The Rolling Stones. It's steeped in that musical heritage. Is it the fact that it went off on a sort of left-leaning or more liberal tangent in its writing that ultimately caused its problems?
I mean, I think it's a little bit more complicated than that. I mean, if you look back to 1967, pop culture in and of itself was a new idea. So pop culture journalism, pop music criticism was in effect an innovation in and of itself. So Rolling Stone not only was innovative in that sense, but also pioneered a new type of journalism, more gonzo style of journalism, which is more in your face, centered around reporters. You know, nowadays, sort of the role media has been playing in terms of creating culture, cultivating American culture, whatnot, has really dispersed through a number of different actors in the media. Rolling Stone, although it was a pioneer in some senses in terms of curating popular culture in the United States, it really hasn't had that leading role over the last decade or so that it once did. So, you know, while there might be criticism of its left-leaning slant, I wouldn't put that insofar as one of the larger reasons why its business has struggled in recent years in particular.
Not necessarily the political slant itself, but just the fact that it became a political thing instead of, well, essentially music.
Yeah, I mean, certainly it played a huge role in American culture in that sense. Just eight or nine years ago, Matt Taibbi, a left-wing journalist, wrote this, you know, seminal work about Goldman Sachs and how the global financial institutions are really controlling a lot of global events. And, you know, not having a very strong sort of in-your-face left-wing voice that comes from a little bit of an alternative perspective, not having that is a real, you know, strike against the American, you know, media environment. And it's unfortunate. So even if you disagree with Rolling Stone, it did produce some great journalism over the course of the years, not only in music, but also politics and finance and what have you.
But look, we're sitting here talking the day after the Emmys and Saturday Night Live was vaunted once again, perhaps because of the times we're living in, but perhaps because people are starting to appreciate those, I mean, dare I say it, heritage or legacy brands like SNL. Why hasn't Rolling Stone sort of been held in the same regard?
I mean, I think like many magazines, it has really struggled. It has shown either an inability or an unwillingness to make the actual investments in a digital transition. So Rolling Stone still puts out a print magazine. It does not have sort of the bandwidth or the wherewithal to produce either a product or a type of journalism that is uniquely digital, that is suited for the internet, that is built for the internet. The innovation with Rolling Stone, as I said at the beginning of our interview, in some senses was a journalistic innovation, and it has not parlayed that into the 21st century in the same way.
And other brands have done it in their own way. I mean, Pitchfork springs to mind, and their reviews and the quality of their writing, and it's online and it's slightly longer form, seems to have sort of taken Rolling Stone online when the magazine itself hasn't been interested in doing that.
Sure, and I think also it just has to do with the type of music that Rolling Stone is following as well. It seems to be catering to a certain class of rock music lovers who, you know, are a little bit older in age, you know, are either from the baby boomer generation or maybe boomer adjacent generation, whereas a lot of the newer, you know, music websites and whatnot that make a lot of noise in the industry but get a lot of media play are increasingly focused toward, you know, new pop music, toward rap and hip-hop, you know, toward, you know, the Selena Gomez's of the world and whatnot. I think, you know, Rolling Stone traditionally shunned those types of voices in favor of, say, U2 or Bob Dylan or someone from the more traditional cathedral of rock music. And I don't think that's the future. I mean, I know for a fact that's not a future, just given what young people listen to in the United States.
But I wonder if the young people will be interested in buying it. Maybe it is a baby boomer, you know, billionaire who might dip into their pockets. How much are we talking about to buy this stake in Rolling Stone, and who's most likely to come up with the cash?
It's hard to say. With a situation like this, I would say tens of millions of dollars. You know, they sold a 49% stake in the magazine last year to an international company.
That's BandLab, I believe.
Exactly. Yes, they're based out of Singapore, and they're trying to parlay the Rolling Stone brand into a more sort of international brand in emerging markets. You know, it's unclear how much they will be able to sell the rest of that stake, but I would certainly say tens of millions of dollars. In a lot of situations like this, you have, you know, sort of private equity companies or other sorts of, you know, investment corporations that invest in the brand. Rolling Stone, there's no question, is a very sort of strong and well-recognized brand in the United States and elsewhere. It's just a question of what exactly they do with that, whether they will try to squeeze the last couple of pennies out of that brand through marketing and advertising and whatnot, or actually invest in the actual journalism that it produces in hopes of making a better product, a more sustainable product over the long term.
Well, that was my next question. I was going to push you on that, because clearly the Wenner family, having had it from its genesis all the way to now, 50 years later, gives it a certain authenticity. Do you think that whoever buys it will have to invest and have to sort of take that genuine rock and roll steeped journalism and coverage online?
Well, they certainly don't have to, but I would say that the idea of having a countercultural rock music magazine owned by a private equity company is in and of itself an oxymoron. So I think depending on who actually buys it, you know, they will have to make some hard choices about what the actual sensibility of the publication will be and what it won't be anymore. One of the names that has been floated here is American Media, which is a tabloid company that owns publications such as Us Weekly and other sort of supermarket tabloids that are very far out there. That would drastically change the publication in terms of its ideological slant, in terms of its journalistic slant and whatnot. So there's really just a lot of open-ended questions at this point, you know, whether someone will purchase this for political ends or financial ends, or just to fold it into a broader portfolio that they hope to squeeze a few extra dollars out of before, you know, launching a lot of these old and fading titles off into the marketplace again.
And I read that American Media, the tabloid empire, is led by David Pecker, who is an ardent Trump ally. That really does seem to be at odds with everything Rolling Stone has done over the past 50 years. David, many thanks indeed for joining us. That was media reporter David Uberty from Splinter. You're listening to the Monocle Daily on Monocle 24.
UBS has over 900 investment analysts from over 100 different countries.
Over 900 of the sharpest minds and freshest thinkers in the world of finance today.
No one has more. No one knows more.
To find out how we could help you,
contact us at ubs.com.
You're listening to The Monocle Daily with me, Matt Barbett. Let's now continue to Lisbon, where publishers and distributors have gathered for the annual Distropress Congress. Monocle's Henry Rees-Sheridan joins me now from the Portuguese capital. Good to talk to you, Henry. Where are you?
I'm sitting, Matt, on the still warm steps leading up to the entrance of the Museum of Art, Architecture and Technology here in Lisbon. And the reason I'm sitting here is because Monocle is hosting a cocktail party on the roof of the museum, which is architecturally possible. And the reason that we're hosting that party is, well, the proximate cause is that Tyler, our CEO, likes parties. But the cause slightly further down the line is, as you mentioned, Distropress, which is the, I think it's the world's biggest press distribution trade show, happening about 20 minutes away in a seaside town called Estoril.
Yes.
Which is slightly down the coast. I'm not sure if you're familiar with this part of the world, Matt.
Isn't Estoril known for its Formula One circuit?
I didn't know that. So I think it's known for a few things. One of the things it's known for is apparently Ian Fleming either began writing or got the idea from the Bond novels while he was staying there during World War II. So the organisers of Distress actually managed to shoehorn a quite incongruous Bond scene into the proceedings today.
which one did they use? Just the regular Bond theme? It wasn't a bit of bassy, was it?
It was kind of vague enough for you not to be able to call them out on any specifics, but specific enough for a general air of Bondness to be conveyed.
And is this the kind of thing that gets press distributors going?
Apparently so. I mean, everyone seems to be loving it. I didn't see any complaints, so I think it caught their attention.
But look, that part of the world, and I'm going to let you into a little bit of my personal history now. I had my stag do a decade ago now, in Lisbon. It's not your usual stag do destination, and we found that at the time. But I came away thinking this was a much more cultured experience than I was expecting, and that's still true of Lisbon and the surrounding towns and cities today, isn't it?
I would say so. I mean, this is my first time here. Was it a much more cultured experience than you wanted?
No, do you know what? I came away thinking that was better than I was expecting, because I was expecting the usual stereotypical shenanigans, and came away thinking, what a lovely city. Very decent of them to go out late, stay out late, laid back.
Sure, it was more edifying than you thought it was going to be.
You hit the nail on the head. Edifying is what it was.
So I should probably tell you a little bit about what went on at Distropress, if you want to hear.
I do.
We could just talk about your stag do.
Not at all. Let's talk about Distropress.
So yeah, as you said in your introduction, all kinds of people who are involved in the business of press logistics, from retailers to wholesalers and distributors, and increasingly actually people who are involved in the digital side of things too, were all gathered together at the Estoril Congress Centre today. And the day kicked off with some really genuinely quite interesting speeches by movers and shakers within the industry. I'll tell you about just three of the ones that I thought were particularly insightful. Marcus Sherbel is a trade journalist. He puts together a monthly digital subscription newsletter called PV Digest. He used to work on the logistics side of things. Now he analyzes the industry. And he did this kind of weirdly fascinating analysis, a really granular analysis of what retailers can do to help boost print sales. And it was mainly concentrated in Germany. It mainly looked at Germany. But I think the principles can be applied elsewhere. He pointed out that the average amount of cover, magazine cover, which is shown of any individual magazine in a German newsstand, is just 11 centimeters. And it stressed the importance of category management, which, to translate to English, is basically making shelves look nice for the sake of selling magazines, and what could be done there. Following him was a woman called Stephanie Freiling. She is the vice president of merchandising at Barnes & Noble, which, as you and the listeners will know, is the largest book retailer in the world. And they really have been doing some really interesting stuff, hybridizing digital and physical sales incentives to get people more engaged. So, for example, they've been giving away free digital content with the purchase of a physical magazine.
Okay.
You know, they've been really boosting their social media engagement to get people into shops to sell physical copies. And I think just generally grasping the bulls by the horns and really using the digital platform as a springboard to actually boost engagement, physical projects, rather than just moving everything online.
Because people, as we know, we're all monocle readers, still like to hold the object. So if you get something a little bit extra online, is that going to add in some way a bit more luster to, you know, the physical magazine or book that you buy in Barnes & Noble? Is that the idea?
Well, I think so. And there was also a presentation by a guy called Jim Bilton. He's a managing director of Distropress. Something that he pointed out was that actually the people who are willing to spend the most on media are actually people who engage in a hybrid manner. So they're people who want to have, you know, the print product, they still value it, but they will also engage with digital. These people are the people who are most willing to spend on both. As soon as you try to target a digital-only audience, those people become very unwilling to spend, even on the digital products that they consume. So I think, you know, kind of gaining a better understanding of what consumers want, and what they might not know they want yet, but what the behaviour of people in their demographic demonstrates they might engage with, can really show a way forward for press distributors in the future.
And I wonder if, Henry, that if you're just going electronic only, online only, there's an inherent fickleness there with the audience that doesn't exist in the same way with people who have to make an effort to get hold of a printed publication.
Well, I think certainly a really big problem with getting people digitally engaged, of course, is just the monopoly that Facebook and Google has on both advertising revenue, but also people's attention. And it has been observed several times during the debate surrounding the increase in fake news. But one of the problems is just the lack of distinction which is made in these websites' interfaces between different brands of journalism. I think that reiterating that brand value is done very effectively through print, first of all. But second of all, it's going to become something that people value much more as they begin to realize that in order to get quality journalism, they have to be, you know, referring to an organization online or offline, which has the resources and the values to actually pull it off.
Henry, let's just throw ahead to what you're going to be up to in the coming hours and days. And you got an interview with Steve McCurry.
Yeah, that's right. So I'm going to be going to Digital Press again tomorrow morning, but then I'm going to be getting on the train going along the coast and interviewing Steve McCurry in Lisbon. He is the photographer most famous for capturing the portrait of the Afghan girl. She came to be known, who graced the front cover of National Geographic.
The striking green
eyes. In 1985. Eyes. Yeah, probably one of the most well-known photographs in the world, never mind National Geographic covers. So I'm going to be talking to him about his life and career tomorrow, and that'll be broadcast as part of the big interview later in the year. I'm very much looking forward to that.
I really look forward to hearing that as well. One of those images, you only need to close your eyes and you can see it in your mind's eye. Iconic indeed. Henry, many thanks indeed. That was Monocle's Henry Rees-Sheridan joining us from Lisbon. Next up, the contrast couldn't be more stark. Canada's Prime Minister is one of the darlings of the global political centre, with many wishing he was running their country. Indeed, Rolling Stone asked exactly that on its front cover just a couple of months ago. His guest is the embattled British Prime Minister Theresa May, right-wing thorn in the side of the European Union, who's fighting for Brexit while she's unlikely to fight another election, and her ministers are fighting to take her job. Joining us from Monocle's Toronto Bureau now is Professor Nelson Wiseman from the University of Toronto. And Nelson, they couldn't be more different, could they?
No, they're very different. Very, very different. Not just left and right, male and female. Security as leaders. Trudeau has a strong majority. May has been weakened and, as you implied, perhaps fatally. May faces a lot of uncertainty with Brexit. Trudeau's in a much stronger position dealing with Trump with respect to NAFTA. In fact, Trudeau seems to be a favorite of Trump's.
But it certainly seems, having seen their joint press conference just a couple of hours ago, they seem to get on.
Oh, they certainly get on. Canada and Britain are very close allies. The relationship isn't as intimate as it once was. Britain's used to be, for maybe a couple of centuries, the largest source of immigration to Canada. That's changed dramatically in the last 20, 30 years. For the last year, we have data. Britain's coming to Canada are number nine. You know, there are many more Filipinos, Chinese, Indians, Sri Lankans, Pakistanis, and so on. Also, Canada used to style itself as something of a linchpin between the British and the Americans, interpreting one to the other. That's changed. Now the Americans and Britain and the Britons talk about having a special relationship. I don't think we can say that Canada does have a special relationship with the U.S. because of the massive trade. But I wouldn't say it's special with a capital S when it comes to matters such as defense and foreign policy. And as evidence of that, The British invaded Iraq along with the Americans. Canada remained aloof.
But back to the here and now, and I think as Britain edges ever closer, and I say edges because it could take years and years yet, but edges closer all the same towards Brexit, it would seek a special relationship with anybody it can at the moment. And Canada certainly seems to be near the top of that list. And the one company that unites both the prime ministers is the Canadian one of Bombardier.
Yes, Bombardier is the largest manufacturer employer in Belfast. About 10% of all the manufacturing jobs there are people working for Bombardier. Bombardier is now involved in a dispute with Boeing, which the Commerce Department in the United States has taken up. The British, Theresa May, has weighed in on the Canadian side because she's concerned about these jobs. These Bombardier jobs, the people in Belfast are, I believe, making the wings for the Bombardier C-Series plane. Bowie doesn't like competition, and May doesn't want to lose those jobs, nor does Canada. Canada is also lobbying governors in the United States, most recently from Missouri, because, you know, a lot of these airplanes are made, and a lot of other goods, in multiple countries. So that's an issue, and for May will be meeting Trump later this week. So the Canadians see her as a conduit and hoping that she'll whisper that in Trump's ear. She has mentioned it to him, but that's not how American trade law works, and I don't think it's a very high priority for Donald Trump.
I mean, the highest priority certainly in meeting Justin Trudeau and Donald Trump from Theresa May's point of view is trying to secure something ahead of official negotiations can begin over a trade deal. But anybody who's familiar with Canada's dealings with the EU knows that it can take a very long time. Certainly in the case of CETA, the EU-Canada trade deal has been years and years in the making.
Yes, about 90% of it is going to come into effect later this week. But what the British are looking at, and also the Canadians, is they feel that CETA can be a template for whatever arrangement to set up between the British and Canadians post-Brexit, if Brexit happens, actually. So there might be a little tweaking, but essentially it's to maintain the arrangement that it was negotiated with the EU. So that would continue. Mm-hmm. And so Britain reaching out to Canada enter to such negotiations is consistent with its reaching out, I think, to maybe 18 other countries already that are in the EU, because it has to anticipate what kind of economic relations, investment relations are we going to have after. I would say, actually, the most important aspect of May's visit to Canada is happening this evening here in Canada. And that isn't so much her meeting with Trudeau, which might surprise you, but it's her meeting tonight with 10 titans of industry and investment in Canada. It's vital for May and the British to convince captains of industry in other countries, pension funds and so on, that Britain will continue to be a safe place in which to invest, in which to build plants, because Britain thinks it will still have access to the European market. Foreigners are not so certain, and this could be an impediment to investment in Britain, and thus May is hoping to overcome those concerns by reassuring Canadian investors, other investors, that not only is Britain open for business, but you can use Britain, you will be able to continue to use Britain as a ladder into the rest of the European community.
Well, certainly she's been given a bit of a boost by the strength of the pound improving, and that happened, well, because of another Canadian, the Governor of the Bank of England, Mark Carney, suggesting that interest rates here might rise from their historic low of 0.25%. So she's obviously looking to several Canadians for a bit of help.
Yes, but Mark Carney's also given notice that he's leaving the position, coming back to Canada. And I should say the Canadian dollar is also increased in value significantly this year. It's really the story here is the decline in the American dollar. And also, Canada is also just starting to raise its interest rates as well. So the difference is that Britain faces a much greater uncertain future. Canada's economic relationship is much more closely tied to the United States than it is with Britain.
And interesting to note, Nelson, just to finish off, that Theresa May will see Trump, as you mentioned there, at the United Nations. He's seeing 12 foreign leaders, but Justin Trudeau will not be one of them.
No, that's the case, but Justin Trudeau has seen him a few times. Britain is a much bigger actor on the world stage. Mm. And Trudeau, as I said, is a Trump favorite.
Okay.
Trump has said positive things about Trudeau in the media that I haven't seen him say in the same way about Theresa May.
Professor Nelson Wiseman, many thanks indeed for joining us here on Monocle 24. Now, this week's edition of our design show, Section D, is celebrating London's Design Festival with a special interview with renowned talent Jasper Morrison. The show is also wrapping up its special Maison et Objet coverage with a selection of design voices from the event in Paris. Here's Monocle's Ben Ryland discovering how Maison de has brought the children's rocking horse into the realm of thoughtful design.
My name is Boes Wijnberg. I'm from Maison de. Today we present ourselves in Hall 7 as a new brand. This year we present a new collection as well. For example, the iconic moon and the hashtag word cubes. Yeah, we're slowly building a collection which is sort of designed for parents, but obviously to use for kids. But really pieces that blend into the interior as you already thought of. Have you, for example, decorated your house with vitra or hay? You would love to include kids' design that blends in nicely. Yeah? For example, we work with quadrat as a fabric for our upholstery, solid oak. So really creative furniture for both. That's why we are called Maison de. So that's what we do here. And hopefully building a collection for the future at Maison.
It's interesting you put it as designing for parents, because I think we hear the concept of designing for children quite often, but in effect, designing for children is designing for parents as well. Do you think that's something that's been missing a lot in the wider industry, this idea that you need to actually design for children, but also in a way that is complementary to how parents might envision their space too?
Exactly. I think we feel that it misses. Eh? When we received our first kids, we really missed design stuff, furniture, but also toys and accessories that are really blend into our home rather than hopefully putting and stacking them away in sort of nice cupboards, etc. But really leave them or even play with them ourselves. What we also see with our iconic rockers, that really parents and grandparents love them for themselves, even want to sit on them themselves or have a bigger one for themselves. And that's what we really see that misses. But also pieces that last. For example, we claim build pieces that last for generations. And that's something we sort of missed. Eye for detail, but also locally sourced, and make sure that it's really a product that you're proud of, rather than my kids, I buy it and it doesn't matter if it breaks. No, it's really a piece that you want to include in your home. Of course it needs to be playful and be able to play with it, but also be part of the interior that you most probably also have designed with eye for detail. You chose a very nice fabric for your couch, etc. So that's sort of what we aim for your kids' design as well.
And built to last, especially for children, I think that's a great concept. Can we just, I wonder if we can walk over and have a look at these, because I think most people, when they approach your stall here, this is the first thing they'll see.
Yeah.
You've got a sign above here that says the new generation of rocking horses, and it should be said for our listeners that the new generation of rocking horse is not actually a horse at all, is it?
No, it is not. The true thing is that my wife, who's the designer, Pia, she actually says, well, why should it be, if you call it a rocking horse, why should it be a horse? So we thought, well, really create icons, build icons, but then sort of give them some feet to rock on. So we started off with the cloud, with the watermelon and the bowler hat, but now we introduce the moon. Yeah, and it could be that we include different shapes, different icons, so to say. For example, last year we kicked off at Colette in Paris, and we designed a rocker for her, which we called the iconic blue Parisian, which has big eyes, but has obviously the blue iconic color of Colette. Yeah, that's something, they all have the same shape, the same legs, but they differ in icon.
I love the new addition here, the moon. It's, I think anyone who recalls those pictures of people posing at Luna Park back in the early 1900s will kind of get an understanding of what you're on to here. We've also got some building blocks here that spell out all sorts of different words. Tell me about them.
We just launched the hashtag word cubes, as we call them. It has the world's first hashtag. They're around quite a lot are the building blocks with different letters, but we added a hashtag and sort of present them in a gift packaging, which allows you to create your, well, of course, create several words, but also present them as a nice gift to your loved one. For example, we have a hashtag happy birthday, hashtag love Paris, hashtag Merry Christmas. And then it sort of gives a fun element when people, for example, which happens quite a lot nowadays, you post a picture of your child with those blocks, but never with hashtag need coffee after a night with no sleep. So, and that's sort of what we do is products, classics from a kid's room, bring them to today, make them more of today.
You've also got a series of posters.
Yeah, those are the minimal prints. Pia designed with one line thickness, but several lengths. She created favorites. For example, our son really loves garbage truck. Each time he sees a garbage truck, he's like, whoa, hey, Dad, look it up. And so we thought, well, let's translate those into really minimalistic and fun designs, with also you as a parent, again, love and could even, well, just present in your living room. Not shouty, but really minimalistic colors.
That was Monocle's Ben Ryland meeting Maison d'Or in Paris. Catch the full edition of our design show, Section D. It's tomorrow, 1900 London time. Coming up, the Asian Papers.
UBS is a global financial services firm with over 150 years of heritage, built on the unique dedication of our people. We bring fresh thinking and perspective to our work, and we know that it takes a marriage of intelligence and heart to create lasting value for our clients. It's about having the right ideas, of course, but also about having one of the most accomplished systems and an unrivaled network of global experts. That's why at UBS, we pride ourselves on thinking smarter to make a real difference. Tune in weekly to The Bulletin with UBS for all the latest insights and opinions from UBS and experts from around the world.
Download Meet the Writers to join me, Georgina Godwin, as I talk to Marcel Theroux, an award-winning writer and a documentary filmmaker from an illustrious creative family. We talk about his father, Paul, his brother, Louis, his cousin, Justin, and his new novel, The Secret Books, which is utterly compelling and so relevant to our times. That's Marcel Theroux on Meet the Writers, available as a podcast now.
The time is 6:43 in the morning in Tokyo, 22:43 in the evening here in London. It's time now for a check of the Asian front pages. We're joined today by Agatha Kratz from the European Council on Foreign Relations. Good to see you, Agatha. And we're going to start with a story in Channel News Asia and its military manoeuvres once again on the Korean Peninsula.
Yeah, but many of them this time. It's lots. Not only the US and South Korea as usual. As the US has said today, they've been conducting these exercises about two or three times a month these days. And by these days, they mean since North Korea has started this whole testing a missile every week kind of brain gain. So there's two sets of drills happening today. First one, as I said, between the US and South Korea, but a second one as well between Russia and China. That's the second. That's the repeat of an exercise that was carried on in July in the Baltic Sea. This will be the second one this year and probably the last one between the two partners. But they've been held very close to the North Korean border, so there might be a sign there.
A lot of muscle flexing going on.
A lot of muscle flexing on both sides. It's quite surprising to see China and Russia doing the same as the US and South Korea on the same day. It's the same message that's being sent, although everyone knows that not all of those partners have the same view at the UN or have the same view in general about what should be done about the peninsula. But I think the North Korean reckless attitude over the past few weeks has just set everyone on the same line when it comes to military exercises, for sure.
It's interesting to remind ourselves that officially the US and South Korea are still at war with North Korea.
Yeah, absolutely. And today more so than ever. But yeah, officially they still are. That's not part of the negotiation in any case. I mean, they're way past that, and I think that detail now.
Let's move on to the South China Morning Post, because they report on five things to look out for when Singapore's leader Lee Hsien Loong visits China.
Yeah, exactly. So Singapore's Prime Minister Lee is going to start a three-day visit to China tomorrow. And why is that important? It's because Singapore and Chinese relations have been a little bit strained over the past few months. That's for a number of reasons. First was the Hague ruling last year, which settled against China and which Singapore has supported, we could say that this way. And so China wasn't too pleased about that. And since, there's been a lot of tensions. In particular, Prime Minister Loong didn't go to the Obor Forum in May, which was a big sign of it rejecting or at least not taking part in the new Belt and Road Initiative that China has been clamoring about for now since 2013. In November as well, Hong Kong seized 9 Singapore infantry carriers that were on a boat from Taiwan to Singapore, back to Singapore after military exercises with Taiwan.
More military exercises.
Yeah, exactly.
They're all doing them.
They're all doing them. But with Taiwan is something that China doesn't really like, although the country has been doing them since 1974, so that wasn't a surprise.
Yeah, it's called the Starlight Project.
Exactly. But, you know, this year was too much for them. So they did seize the carrier. So, you know, it's been a tough year for the bilateral relations. Mm. So we'll see what happens. But there's been a number of declarations on both sides that may have a thing that is going to get a little bit better, at least.
And one of the reasons, perhaps, for this invitation from the Chinese Premier Li Keqiang is that it could benefit China industrially in terms of developing parts of Singapore.
Which one are you referring to?
Talking about some civil engineering projects that they've got
Absolutely.
Their eye on doing.
Yeah, exactly. So China is hoping to win and definitely bidding for the Kuala Lumpur Singapore project, which is due to open bidding in the end of this year, although it's been kind of postponed for a number of times, so no one exactly knows when it's going to happen. In this, what's very interesting is it in this deal in particular, China will be facing Japan, which is kind of a replay of the Hulk geostrategic opposition that's happening. So that's going to be a very big one to look at.
Nothing if not difficult in that part of the world.
Yeah.
Let's move on to the Philippines. And at first glance, this headline in the Straits Times sounds like good news. President Rodrigo Duterte invites UN rights bodies to set up office as drug killings climb.
Yeah.
But when you dig a bit deeper, you realize that perhaps he might be part of the problem.
He's part of the problem for sure, because what he's inviting the UN's human rights monitors and rapporteurs to do is to come to the country to monitor his own drug war, which allegedly killed about 3,800 people since he was elected in June 2016. So there's been a very bloody war so far on drugs, and there's been a lot of criticism about, well, human rights concerns, of course, and the fact especially that last month 2 teenagers were killed. Of course, the police says it was in self-defense, but a lot of critics said it was just a cold-blooded murder, really.
And he's reached out to the UN in terms of having his own human rights appraised. But in his own country, Duterte and his allies were chided after giving the Philippines Commission on Human Rights an annual budget of the equivalent of 1,000 pesos, which I think is 26 Singaporean dollars, which is
$25.
Is offensive. It's peanuts.
It's absolutely offensive. He also added that he would spend the whole, you know, last year's budget, which was 678 million pesos. I'm not sure what that makes, but much more in terms of budget on cameras for the police. So, you know, once again saying he would do something good on the drug war, but obviously there's a lot of controversy there.
But this report also quotes Duterte. He was taunting the head of the Philippines Commission on Human Rights by asking him if he was gay or a paedophile and if he was smitten with teenagers, which doesn't strike you as the language of a genuine statesman, does it really?
No, absolutely not. But we've gotten used to Duterte saying stuff like that for the past 18 months. You can remember a number of words that I can't repeat here, but that he said about Obama, that he said about the Pope, and, you know, terrible, terrible things.
Same old, same old. Let's just finish off, yeah. Agatha, with this story about China sending over 100 pollution inspection teams to cities around Beijing, also in the South China Morning Post today.
Yeah, absolutely. So China is going to be sending 100 environmental inspection teams in 28 cities in China. And the reason for that is that, well, China has turned into an extremely polluted country. Everyone knows that. But it's gotten extremely bad in the big cities to the point where it's now called airpocalypse. Pretty much every winter this comes back. You have cities just covered in a huge smog of pollution. So the aim here is just to try and make sure that, governors and local officials do their job. Because, of course, China has for long been promoting measures and improvements in air pollution. The issue is that governors or officials don't do their job.
But it's interesting, is it sending them to cities around Beijing? Maybe it's the number of cities that is quite simply the problem, and to combat that kind of air pollution is going to be difficult, nigh and impossible, with so many people living in close proximity to each other.
Absolutely, but one of the huge issues there is that Chinese northern cities are mostly coal-powered, and burning coal is just creating a lot of pollution. So one of the things that have been announced, though, is that in the Hebei, gas is now going to be one of the main resources.
Okay. Agatha, many thanks indeed. Agatha Kratz, joining us here on the Monocle Daily. Jennifer Guarini Miraldi is a curator, gallerist and writer known for looking further afield. She runs JGM. It's a London gallery dedicated to contemporary Indigenous Australian art. And she's now co-curating an exhibition at London's Griffin Gallery that focuses on both that field and the work of contemporary artists based here in London, entitled Earth, Wind and Fire. Earlier on, Monocle's Tom Edwards and Daniel Giacopelli met Jennifer to hear more about it. And Tom began by asking what inspired the creation of the show.
It's been a long journey dealing with Indigenous Australian art. And my long-term dream has always been to see it as just contemporary art, which is comparable to any contemporary art and the best contemporary art being made today. So in a way, when I met Juan Bolivar, who's my co-curator at Earth, Wind and Fire at the Griffin Gallery, I thought he got it, basically. And I was so excited. This was a couple of years ago when the idea first hatched. And I thought, this is exactly where I want to be. I want to show these Indigenous artists who are just so full of soul and life and energy with any contemporary art being made today. So here the dreams come true at Griffin.
Would you say there are a lot of misperceptions about that sort of art here in London, for instance?
There are problems. There are problems with alcohol in communities. There are large problems with kidneys and the change of diet of Aboriginal people. So there are problems. There's also a great youth suicide problem. But those things are really picked out. Now, the art in all of the major communities across Australia has lifted some of the bad cloud from a lot of communities. And the Aboriginal people themselves, I feel, have really regained self-esteem. And it's a joy to behold, yeah.
And tell us a bit more then about what people will see in the exhibition itself. And maybe talk a bit about how you and Juan Bolivar have looked at bringing the works together, particularly with those British contemporary artists, because presumably, therefore, there are, you know, conceptually, there are themes, and in terms of techniques, there'll be themes which are similar and which completely, as you say, blur any distinction or boundary or unhelpful labels from without. It must have been a very exciting curatorial process for you both to work on.
Very exciting. And I call some of the artists that are showing at the Griffin, some of the British or artists working in Britain, I call them the Juan Bolivar School, because he himself has a very keen eye for the best, or some of the best contemporary art being made today. And his choices of what to put with the Indigenous pieces that I selected was just so enlightened. And then when I arrived at the exhibition and he'd painted some of the walls in the most lurid cerise colour, I thought, oh, this man is so inspired. And the art, it's very difficult sometimes to see which is Indigenous and which is non-Indigenous, because there's pattern making in a lot of the works that Juan selected, and pattern making is a big part of Indigenous art, tribal kind of patterns that have, you know, sometimes been now date back to 80,000 years. So that comes through pattern making and map making and so on. So there's some sort of similarities, but the fact is it's not the premise to say we chose these artists because they're so similar. We're just saying this art sits beautifully together. Mm. It doesn't matter what the origin. Lily Hargraves Nungarai is another of my favourite, and Kitty Malavy both have big works in the Griffin Gallery, and they're just, you can get lost in these paintings, 3 by 4 metres. They're just stunning works.
Well, Australia is a country of scale, and I wanted to ask you a bit about that. Obviously, you're from Australia originally,
yes.
And you, when you do travel back, and particularly when you head out to Kimberley or your Northern Territories and you go on these, I don't know if they're fact-finding missions or just to follow the art.
Do
you go to the centres? Do you just go out on your own and wait and see what you can find? What are those processes like?
You know, it's quite a lonely pursuit. I travel with a friend of mine from Melbourne who is a collector, and she also has a fantastic eye, so I like to travel around with her. She's called Georgina Weir, and she's in the fashion world, funny enough, but she's a great collector of Indigenous art. And, you know, we have to hire small Cessnas with a pilot to fly around the communities, because the distances are, as you
say,
there isn't
really a short hop, is there?
Well, you know, it's really every big property and every art centre and every little small town has an airstrip. So it's kind of like up and down, up and down. Mm. Like,
it's like it's Indiana
like
Jones.
Being in a car, but it's yeah. in the air. And you fly very close to the ground a lot of the time. So you see the vastness, the fabulous landscape. It's tremendously exciting.
That was Jennifer Guarini-Miraldi of London's JGM Gallery talking to Monocle's Tom Edwards and Daniel Jacopelli. And that's it for today's edition of the Monocle Daily. The show was produced by Marcus Hippie. The researchers were Daphne Karnizis and Miriana Lagrasta. Our studio manager was Sarah Miles. The Globalist is here in 8 hours' time with Ty Enright. The Monocle Daily is back at the same time tomorrow. I'm Matt Barbett. Thanks for listening.